greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. Early in 2024, I'm your host, Jay Hersko. Joining me once again, I have our regular, Mr. Mike Cadell. Mike, thanks for tuning in.
Howdy, y'all.
Hello, and joined once again with us to talk about his new book this week. The book's title is Deliver Better Results. We have Mr. Gil Broza. Gil, thanks for joining. Gil, hot question, right? You're up in Canada. Do you have snow? Yes or no?
No, we don't.
Oh, did anybody get snow for Christmas? We didn't get snow either.
Nebraska did.
Right. You got to be in the bowels of the Midwest. All right. So back to the task at hand here. So we, for our audience, we actually started having this conversation. Then I realized we needed to hit record. So we're going to do a bit of a cold open. Again, we're having Gil back. We're going to talk about his new book, Deliver Better Results. Gil, you started out with saying this is one of the harder books you've had to write. Can we explain a little bit? Not to rehash the conversation that we just had, but I think our audience would find that interesting. How does this one compare to, say, Agile for Non-Software Teams, the last book that we had to have you on to talk about?
There is something in common to those books in that they help you get better. They draw a path. They show you, well, if you're at this point, you should do that. The new book is more general. It's not Agile specific, it is Agile friendly. If you're doing Agile, using Agile, being Agile, this is definitely a great book for you. But it is not, it is intentionally not in that narrow space. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the space. I don't like that it's narrow, but let's face it, most of software development in the world, companies do their own things. Some will use Agile as described, a framework as described, but ultimately everybody customizes, changes, picks this and that, contexts everything. And so I was writing to all the people who build software products, technological products, and just need to get better without imposing a target state, without saying, here's how it's going to be, without even describing a maturity model or a capability model that is very specific to a framework. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I also needed to word things a certain way and to pick certain terminology that people would see themselves in and not be turned off by.
Right, right. And to your point, not a lot of usage of the A word. Not a whole lot of usage with the A word. It's used where it makes sense. For those of you that have dirty minds, we're talking about the Agile word. The Agile word. You use it where it makes sense, but you can tell that is just one particular flavor or one particular color of crayon in the box. And that jumped out at me very early on because I think we're all safe. We're all adults here. I think it's safe to say that a lot of the companies that we've come across or worked with, their problems may not have anything to do with Agile or Waterfall or Lean or any of those things. There's some general structural things. There's some general good behaviors, mm-hmm. suggested behaviors that a lot of companies struggle with. And that's where I think this book for me, I was texting Mike as I was reading. So I'm like, Mike, you were on with last time Gil was on. You know, here's a copy. Check this out. And Mike and I were going back and forth, and I kept saying, dude, I'm really into this because, like, to your point, Gil, not a lot of jargon, not a lot of like industry specific stuff. You're really just talking about, look, if this is where you struggle, this is what you should look at.
Yeah. Kind of as a illustration of what you're just saying, Jay, next week I'm starting a new client gig working with a company that's been kind of doing the same thing for about 25 years and realizes they need to do some things differently. They have adopted the Scaled Agile framework. And as I was reading this, I'm like, I'm totally bringing this book with me because they, you know, just from what I know of this organization, they can take the ideas here and apply them in a Scaled Agile environment and not be doing anything that's going to cause the SPCs to lose their minds and also more importantly that it'll guide them. So I think kind of hot take from reading it through over the last week or so, it's I think you hit a sweet spot, Gil. So we'll talk a bit more about what that, why I think that's a sweet spot. You hit the sweet spot.
Well, I'm actually really glad for this feedback, because this is really what I was going for, and it was super hard to do. And this book went through multiple feedback cycles. I mean, all my books have, but here I think it was even a bit more critical. Yeah.
So let's start. And for those of you that are listening, those of you that are maybe catching a video clip, please pick this up. This is up, and we're going to have Johanna on to talk about her new book. These are the two books I've actually suggested to all of the people I'm in my orbit, in my current place. I'm like, look, we got to read these two. Can we read these as a book club back to back? Because I think these two are really going to change how we look at what we're kind of struggling through. And to start, Gil, you introduce the idea of systems thinking as the window to view change, right? And no offense to, not throwing shade or mud or anybody, but there are certain modalities and certain frameworks inside of our world that have a very almost solipsistic way of looking at things. The blinders go on, and this is the way to do things. And we forget the forest for the trees. For me, the first thing that jumped out, and I was texting Mike, I was grinning reading this. The first thing you lean on is, look, we have to look at this holistically. It's not just a slice or a piece. Maybe the change starts with a slice or a piece, but you need to optimize the whole thing. And I think that's a very, again, and you approach it in a very non-jargony way. Like, look, this is, and you call it fitness for purpose as a consideration of value delivery. Are we fit for purpose and what we're trying to do? That resonated with me really quick. That was the first note I have, and I have a whole shit ton of my Kindle. That was the first thing I highlighted.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about this thing with system, because the organization is a system, right? And I'm not talking about what you need to do to the entire organization. It's not that type of management book. We have lots of those. At the same time, we're not looking at the system that is a team, right? We have lots of literature about that as well. But what most people don't seem to be working with as explicitly and intentionally as I suggest there is with this construct that is, you know, one level of magnitude above a team, but below that of the company, right? Which is what I refer to as this value delivery system. And the idea is it's like this entire cast of characters that participates in doing work that results in delivering value to people who matter. So that is a system, and I deliberately call it system and not value stream, because decisions and choices in one part will have knock-on effects elsewhere, and not necessarily in a linear fashion like you might assume by hearing the term value stream.
I like that. Right? I like that.
I mean, in a lot of companies, they have identified value streams. What I've seen, and it's just my small sample, you know, from some recent clients, it's sometimes a little bit smaller than it needs to be. There are actually more people involved than they have identified as being part of the value stream. But they do say, well, it is, you know, our product people and our designers and our engineers and SREs and whatnot. And that's great. But there is still a little bit of a sense of workflows from left to right, from up to down. You put it on a board and you just see things move and you look for delays and bottlenecks and this and that. None of which is wrong, but I think it's part of the picture. It's part of the picture in that choices that people make, human beings like you and I and me, right? The choices we make have knock-on effects that you will not see on a process board. Okay.
Very true.
Yeah. Some things you will see in the form of delays and bottlenecks and rework and whatnot. But we have so many things happen to us in the context of a human system. If we want jargon, the term is socio-technical. I did not use this term in the book because I don't want to scare people away, right? I just call it human system or work system. We'll do all sorts of things. We, as an engineer, product person, manager, program manager, will make all sorts of decisions that have effects elsewhere, and we won't know what to do about them. So this wants to call them out.
Yeah, so on the topic of the socio-technical, I think that's the word to use.
Yeah.
I've recently had a very interesting dialogue with one of my peers. In my company, we refer to this as the system of work. Mm-hmm. And I offer the idea that you have the system of work and then you have the human system that operates the system of work. And they kind of interact and are part of each other. And We've had some interesting debates about, well, if they operate the system, they're part of it. And but at the end of the day, it's there's the processes and the tools and the people, and
exactly, and that's how I define it in the book, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's the people and their way of working. And also, when I say way of working, I define it as mindset plus tactics, right? So both how we make choices and what we specifically actually do with our process and practices and roles and artifacts and tools and whatnot. And we had that conversation 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's everybody involved, including their management, all the way up to, let's say, CTO, if that's your situation, right? Everybody who makes a call that affects what comes out the other end of the system is part of it.
Go on, Mike.
To the mindset and tactics, I'd add there's also a dynamic that that we like to look at, measures or metrics. And so the idea being that, you know, my years ago, I remember my dad telling me, you get what you measure. So be careful what you measure.
Still true.
He was a highway engineer, and I learned a lot about people from him. But so the measures, you know, kind of relate to the mindset, and then the measures then drive the tactics, and they all fit together is kind of how I think about it. But I'm curious, you know, how does that land for you?
Look, it's all quite intricate. So I would say measures are, in a way, part of our tactics. So rather than just say practices, I use this umbrella term tactics, because we have practices, we have roles and responsibilities, we have team structure, topology, tool usage, how we write our tickets in Jira, whatnot. Measures or metrics are part of that, right? And so we might say, well, we value frequent delivery, so we're going to measure it. And measuring the delivery is partly a result of some tactics we choose, such as continuous integration, but it also affects them. So that's why it's all systematic, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that you make a change or you make a call in one part, that will affect something either obviously or not obviously.
Mm-hmm. And right.
You know this expression, you know, side effects are effects you just didn't bother thinking about, or some variation of it, right? So in a system, technically speaking, I'm sure somebody's going to catch me on this one. There's no really side effects. Everything is an effect. But some of the effects are so far beyond your field of vision, because, you know, one thing leads to the other, to the other, to the other, that you don't necessarily know about this.
Right. As a service to the complexity of the system, you can't.
Exactly.
I can't know that I'm going to flip this lever and 6 days and six standard deviations from me, some Gil in a different department is going to have all of his builds are going to break, and we're not going to know why. Yeah.
And that's at the code level. You can have this with pretty much anything that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You change your template for the user story, and all of a sudden somebody says, well, I didn't get the detail, but this person is now off on holidays. I'm going to be assuming stuff and whatever. And before you know it, there is a knock-on effect. Mm. And we can't avoid this, right? So in the book, I'm not saying, well, here's how you can manage it away. You can't. But the big idea in the book is make your choices with the system in mind, work with your colleagues, right? Don't just solve locally. And when you do solve for improvements, make them gradually in a particular sequence, because some depend on others. That's basically it.
Kind of along the lines of system, there's I think early on there was a good bit of emphasis on the idea of boundaries and the role that boundaries in a system play. Mm-hmm. That kind of jumped out to me as well.
That caught my eye too, because to your point, Gil, sometimes we see, to use the overlaid term value stream, I've been places where they've defined a value stream that it's entirely too small. It's not completely encompassing of all the work needed. But right. I've also seen the other side,
of course,
where we've made a value stream that's like, is there anybody not in this thing? Like, who's missing? Can we get the janitors? Yes. Can we get the janitors in there? So it's very much a think about where that bounded context lands, right? And And that was the other thing I took away from this book is it's not a book that if you're listening and you're struggling with whatever you're going on, you could say, oh, I'll just read this book and I'll pick 1, 2, 4, and 8. And then I'm good. I could just apply those. You keep bringing it back to, you need to understand everything holistically. You need to take the time to do the analysis, right? Mm-hmm. The digging, the old Einstein. If I have 60 minutes to live and it depends on me solving a problem, I'll spend 55 asking questions. There's an emphasis in the book I picked up of, look, you got to know where you're at to know where you, to understand better where you, how you're going to get to where you're trying to go. And I think sometimes people lazily just say, oh, okay, this graph works, this pattern works from this framework. I'm just going to use those. We're gold.
Right. So I want the reader to be aware of what they're doing. I want them to understand where they are. I want them to do this collaboratively, because nobody can single-handedly improve the system, including the most senior person at the top of the pyramid. At the same time, I tried to make this simple. So for instance, you mentioned fitness for purpose, right? So what is that? It's really, you know, to what extent or how well does the system of work help the company achieve its mission and objectives? Well, how would you know what's your current fitness for purpose? Well, before we even ask this question, we need to ask, well, why should we care, right? Are we looking for a vanity metric, or are we looking to prove how awesome we are? Well, no. I mean, I include an assessment in the book of basically a little tool for assessing fitness for purpose so that you know what to do now,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's no point gaming it, because if you game it and you paint yourself in brighter colors,
Oh. Did we lose Gil?
He's frozen.
I think we lost him.
Oh, man.
Let me pause. Hold on. Technical difficulties. Hold on. All right, everybody. We're back. A little bit of technical difficulties. Gil, you were saying we were talking about assessments, and then we were talking about, you started to say if you want to paint yourself in more rosier of colors.
Yes. Right. So the way the assessment works is you're making a qualitative assessment. It's a judgment call. Again, make it collaboratively with your colleagues, compare notes and all that. But of course, it's subjective. And so you might paint yourself in rosier colors. That's actually not going to help you. So if your system's fitness is at a level 2, but the way you've assessed it, you came out level 4, it's going to give you recommendations that you can't actually apply now.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one of the things that jumped out for me, right? So for our readers, listeners, there's an assessment, which then tells you, okay, so based upon your feedback, this is where we think you land, and this is what we think you could do. Mike, we've had long conversations about agility health assessments, right? And everybody suffers from Dunning-Kruger. And like you said, Gil, we gild the lily. We paint a rosier picture than we are. One of the things that really jumped out at me with what you're presenting is, if I tell myself I'm a 3, and just argument's sake, and I try to approach level 3, and I've yet to master levels 1 or 2, real quickly, I'm going to be like, well, what is this? And you're going to throw your hands up, because you're not ready for that. You haven't mastered the easy parts. And that's a real quick feedback loop of saying, maybe I was being a little bit too generous on where we put ourselves.
Right. Now, I do want to say one more thing about the assessment. It doesn't use metrics. It is intentionally designed to take 10 minutes. So my goal with it was that like the really senior people use it. Yes, you can have team leads and engineering managers and product leads and whatnot, and you probably should. But I wanted the CTO, the VP Eng, the VP product to be able to say, all right, here's something that I can use. Really takes me 10 minutes, maybe 15 the first time, because I need to understand how this thing even works. And now I have a read on where we are right now. So I can check whether we've done the previous work so mm-hmm. that our currently assessed value level is actually real. It's sustained. And then from that, what do we need to do next? I really didn't want to use metrics for another reason. And that's the garbage in, garbage out. Nobody has a complete set of metrics that covers the system. Some companies have lots of metrics, and we know the effect that has. But then you can easily mislead yourself and think that you have this or that. But what I've noticed, and this came from working with so many clients and also having lots of discovery calls with companies that did not turn out to be clients. The leaders know. They know to what extent their system works or doesn't. So when I did this assessment verbally with people in person over Zoom, whatever, they know. That's how I know it takes 10 minutes. So when I ask them, all right, so for instance, in terms of, you know, achieving outcomes, what would be optimal, like the practical relevant optimum for your system be? They kind of know, even if they struggle to articulate it, they know because they've been there. And then I say, well, okay, think about how things are right now. And they know. And then I ask, okay, so how things are right now, is it always an issue? Does it keep coming up in management conversations? Does it keep bugging people? Okay, then that's a far. Or is it good enough? We don't even talk about it. It's part of the furniture. It's just how it is. That's a near. So your current state is near the optimum. And if it's neither, then it's midway. That's the level of granularity. And from that, we can assess a fitness level. Will this cover 100% of the hundreds of thousands of companies out there? Probably not. Will it cover enough to be relevant and useful? By far.
Yep. And to your point, it is light and simple enough that it's giving you, you know, give me the way the wind is blowing. Okay, the wind is blowing this way. Well, that's the way that we should, this is how we turn the sails. And I really, really like that. Mike, I feel like I've been yammering on. Thoughts?
Yeah, as Skill was describing that, you know, 10 minutes running through my head was, I would love to see how different people at different parts of the organization evaluate their fitness for purpose, because that could be very interesting information about different views and perceptions.
Right. So let's talk about this a little bit. First off, you need to be very clear about the boundary of the system. And so anybody who's taking this assessment needs to know that we're talking about the same boundaries. We're talking about the same people doing this work. Okay, fine. Second thing is, you actually do need to know it a little bit, right? You can't have been hired last week, right? You need to have been in it, let's say, for a few months, because some of the cycles in our work, they take months, right?
Yeah.
So there's that. The other is, what I'm asking people to assess, those fitness aspects, they're all outward looking, right? So solving user problems, the amount of usable software that we deliver in short spans of time, the cost efficiency of doing certain things. I am assuming that the person has some manager/lead position, so they actually know how to answer this. And what I've found from, again, testing this with, I don't know how many people, the typical director has no problem answering this. Of course, the VP or C-level, no problem at all answering this. Sometimes engineering managers or product managers, it kind of depends. Now, the rest of the book is, what will all of these people do? So the assessment is not a central piece in this model. It's simply a tool for you to know what you need to do next.
Yeah, and you touched on a point there. It's a model that guides you as opposed to a prescription to try to fill. And that really jumped out at me it's like, wow, it's not the, you know, hit the outer part of the radar chart or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't care if you are elite by industry standards or this and that. You want to be better. Every reader, I assume, wants to either make their system better to deliver better results, or they have to do that because things are kind of broken or behind or slow or people are demotivated or whatnot. Okay, so I'm assuming this motivation on part of the reader. I'm also assuming the motivation, borne out by plenty of years in this industry, that nobody likes to be told. They don't like to be told, hey, this will solve all your problems. Hey, that is how you'll be successful. Fill in the blank. Call it whatever. Scrum, Kanban, Safe, Waterfall, Lean, TOC, whatever. That will solve every problem that you have. Now, it might turn out, after you do what some of the things I suggest for level one, that one of those actually is what you need. Okay, fine. But I don't want you putting, you know, the cart before the horse and saying, well, we're going with this model, come hell or high water, and then we'll bend reality to fit it. because you're not going to get a fit for purpose system this way.
Right. The old, what is it? The no free lunch theorem. If there is no, just do it. And everybody does it and it'll just work. Just trust me. You're right. You're right. It's very much, yeah. We in our search for speed, we sometimes lose sight of the forest for the trees.
Yeah. And one of the things that really rung out for me was looking at the dimensions of this model. They ring very true to areas that I've found helpful. So I don't want to give away the whole book, but it focuses on throughput, outcomes, timeliness, adaptability, consistency, and cost efficiency. And you think about it, you know, Jay, throughput is the first thing. And like, you know, I was reading that and Jay and I were like, oh yeah, okay, this makes sense. And then outcomes as opposed to anything else. So if you're moving work through the system and you're getting good outcomes, that really gets you a long way. So there's like you said, there's some subjectivity, but there's also, I think, a brilliant simplicity in it.
I think the subjectivity is unavoidable. Yeah. Even when you use metrics, right? We can do all the analysis we want on the stars of the industry and the industry and getting all sorts of industry standards and how many times per day and whatever, but we can only do this to things that are in fact repeatable and codifiable, right? For instance, how many times a day you deploy, that is a hard metric, right? Solving user problems, wicked hard, right? Timeliness. How do you measure timeliness? Well, it's not about hitting deadlines, right? Because we can impose artificial deadlines. And then what? Not only that, because we work in a system, if we impose deadlines, then we create other effects, right? Not always good ones. So how do you even measure that, right? I talk about cost efficiency. Everybody can cut costs, but that does not make them inefficient. And it also doesn't mean that if you cut those costs, you're not going to hurt some other things, which is practically what we saw in 2023.
Yeah, I think the subjectivity, like you said, Gil, is unavoidable. It's also, I think, beneficial. As an example, I've worked at an organization a while back where we got our development shop to the point where our customers and our support folks were telling us to slow down on our deployments because they couldn't keep up with the pace of change was too much for the user. So deploying every day in that environment would have been a disaster. So it is very contextual.
So I can tell you a story from writing this book. It's my fourth book. I have a process, right? The process is very agile because the book is content development and all of that. I did everything that made sense based on my assumptions. It was a very similar process to what I had when I wrote the previous book, Agile for Non-Software Teams. But it should have worked, but it didn't.
Huh.
Because one of my assumptions turned out to be wrong. And the assumption was, I can get feedback quickly. And in 2023, a lot of people had other priorities and other concerns, and getting feedback was super hard. I'm more connected than I've ever been, and still it was really, really hard. And getting the feedback took a while. So if we use, you know, critical path terminology, the critical path was getting the feedback, but I would not compromise on that because the book was so, you know, in a way pivotal. And, you know, it's a bit of a new subject. So I really did not want to, compromise on feedback. That drew out my schedules like nothing else. But what I found myself doing is writing too much before getting enough feedback.
Mm.
And then when somebody said, you know, two people made a comment on the style and how different it was from my previous books. And then I looked at it and said, oh my God, they're right. And what followed was a month of rewrites. So we can't always get a standardized process, even if it's our own.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about companies here. I'm talking about the single individual writing something that really involves, for the most part, myself. I have done this before. I'm a process guy. I don't need to worry about, you know, team dynamics, because there is no team. It's just me, right? And still, the process should have worked, but didn't.
That sound familiar, Jay?
Yeah.
Writing a
yeah.
long bit and then getting feedback.
Yeah, yeah, I did that. Mike is one of my two editors, Gil, and I'll tell you. Yeah, I learned very early on that I got to stop dropping these 15,000 word pieces and have them to review them, because with the feedback that comes is, yeah, it's not fast. It's great, but it's not fast. So yeah, it's, yeah.
Well, I fell into the same trap as companies do, which is people are available, so they might as well work. And so I spent time where I should have been getting feedback. And again, I tried. It's definitely not for lack of trying, but I spent some of that time kind of getting ahead and creating more of the draft, more of the manuscript. And then when the stylistic feedback came back, after 10 people had said nothing, they only commented on content, then I practically had to rewrite the whole thing.
Oof.
And this book went through more iterations than anything I've ever done. I'm glad with how it turned out. Now I think it is, in fact, more in the voice of, you know, my previous works, but it did not start out this way.
Yeah. Gil, there was something that caught my attention in the bit about the assessment and moving from level to level. Don't remember the exact words, but the essence of it was pick 2 or 3 or 4 things out of 10 and work on those and then move on. Yeah. Could you talk about that a bit? Cause that, you know, some people may, that may be like a mind blowing or
foreign concept. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So first let's correct something here. You don't pick them. So there are 10 strategies all told. Each of them needs to be applied across the system. So not just in an engineering team, not just in an agile team, but across the system. And if you're at level 1, you need to execute these 2. They're strategies, they're high level. You can do them, you know, in various ways. Once you have executed both past a certain threshold, the book says what it is, like what you, how you would know that it's enough, then you have arrived at level 2. Sustainably. At level 2, there's another set of 2 strategies, which assumes that the first 2 are now baked in. You execute those, pass their threshold, you get to level 3. And then there's 3 more, gets you level 4. Then there's 3 more, you get to level 5. That's it.
I see. So you're not trying to do all the things all at once.
No, and that was actually one of the keystone elements of the model, because something I'm sure both of you have done, I have done enough, pretty much every coach out there has done, is we know all of this good stuff, we want people to enjoy it and benefit from it, and we just give them everything.
Yeah.
Right? Because like, why not?
Guilty.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so you're already working in sprints and limiting your WIP, why should you not also write automated tests and while you're out there, do TDD because it's better, and all of that goodness, and it is goodness. But what happens again and again is that people just have limited tolerance for this. The other thing is that some of these, in order for them to really stick, you need other things to be in place. For instance, limiting WIP, it's not a process matter, it requires trust. If you haven't built enough trust into the system, which happens in some of the level 1 strategies and then level 2, limiting WIP is not going to help you much, because you will feel watched, because there will be all sorts of unsafe behaviors and all of that. And then we get to gaming the system. Mm-hmm. So we can show lower WIP, like we close a ticket when it's premature and all of that stuff. Yeah, so the big deal here is sequential and incremental strategies. That's the big deal. Yes.
You touched on something, Mike, and then I'm just going to interject this. You touched on something which is very true, Gil, and Mike will tell you, I'm one of those people where I want to share everything, and I'll bet you Mike probably picks up, catches 1 of every 5 books that I suggest, right, because I'm going so fast. And you're right, I really should look in that mirror when I'm coaching, or we all should look in that mirror when we're coaching and say, there are tons of great things out there. Let's start with just one. Let's start with one, maybe two. Can we start with this before we get to that? And I think that's it's a natural excitement thing. It's a curiosity thing. It's a joy, but it's also like we got to take it down and meet people where they're at because not everybody is operating at the same speed.
It's not just excitement. We work with organizations. They live for the next quarter or for their company vision or for whatnot. They want stuff done well yesterday, right? And that's not a bad thing. And so the question is, well, how do you get to that point, right? And that's actually one of the differences between this book and pretty much everything else, because everything else either says, here's the target state, make it happen. Or it says, look at your biggest offenders and fix them, like theory of constraints, right? And value stream mapping and so on. So look at your biggest offenders, fix them. This one is something else. This one is, you can think of it as a recipe for getting healthy. It's not just a progression for being able to run 10K or, you know, losing 10 pounds. It's a recipe for being healthy. So if your current level of health, which again, a fitness for purpose, is two, here are two things you need to do to get to level three. You will not get to level five out of the gate. It's too much. There are too many things depend on each other.
I'll be honest, I thought of the last couple of places that Mike and I have worked together at one or two, last couple of engagements I've had. And not to overshare the book, everybody go, please go pick up a copy. Level one is manage the project portfolio with greater strategic control over committed and in progress items. This is like, duh. And I can't tell you how many places I've worked where we actually struggle to do this. And yet when I look at your levels, we were struggling to do this, but then we're on level three. We're telling ourselves, oh, we're on level three and we need to do A, B, and C. And it's like, well, time out. We're not even doing the basics right. And that's what that's where the frustration sinks in. That's where the, hey, what are we spending our money on? And all those ugly gremlins start coming out from out of the corners and under the desk. Yeah.
And you can actually be at level three without really managing a project portfolio. However, it won't be sustainable. You won't be able to improve from there. And chances are it will start unraveling when there's trouble.
Right. Those are the key points. It's not sustainable. And the first sign of conflict, things are going to start falling. Things are going to start falling off / falling apart.
Yeah. And so here's something interesting, right? Managing the product portfolio happens outside the team. In the Agile world, we mostly focus on the team or multiple teams, like if it's, less or something. And teams cannot control the product portfolio. It's not in their sphere of influence. And yet we try to, limit whipping the teams and get the teams to collaborate and to feel safe and whatnot. But if they keep being overburdened, and yes, that is the Kanban term, right? Because the idea kind of comes from that. Then you won't be overly successful that way. Okay.
It's back to, it's part of a larger system of work and you gotta, so it's, are you working on the right things? Are you working on them in the right way? And then how are you making decisions about them? That's the kind of threads that came through to me.
Yeah. Now the other level one strategy is, are you also set up for what matters? So that is a way of working, the structure, the process and whatnot. And a recommendation I make there in more than one place is don't jump straight to the familiar or favorite or popular in terms of how we set ourselves up or the process that we have. For instance, picking SAFe or large scale Scrum or Kanban or what have you, right? Instead, identify what parameters of setup matter for your success.
Right.
And by the way, this is something that Agile coaches have seen all the time, right? You can work with a single team and you can try to, run impediments for them and to optimize how they work and whatever, but maybe optimizing this one team is actually not in the interest of the entire system.
Right.
Maybe you have the one architect on your team, but the one architect is also needed for some other work. But by you protecting their time and making them available to your team, you may be holding other teams back, right? And so that's why we need to optimize for the whole system. And that might give rise to some unusual structures. I give a few examples in the book. It might give rise to a somewhat different process, but I'm not telling you how it's going to be. I'm giving you some good ideas, some principles, some pointers, some red flags, mostly of the nature of, if you do this, you can expect this knock-on effect in the system,
right?
And the rest is up to you. Because it is, you know what? It is fundamentally up to the reader. Nobody is going to follow exactly what's written in a book, right? People have their own complex realities, including the specific people they have on staff, the specific management, the business landscape, the pressures and the economy and this and that. Nobody's going to follow exactly what's written in the book. So I try to keep it high level enough to be, you know, practical, but also not so theoretical that you say, well, now what?
And I mean, man, for those listeners, Mike and I did at least two pages of notes. We could talk for hours on this. One of the things you talked about, Gil, you know, like you just said, maybe optimizing one system isn't one team isn't the best use of your time because there's bigger things at play. I wish Lef was here to talk about car parts because he's a big car guy. And here, the first thing he'll tell you is you can't just strap a turbocharger on the car and say, okay, well, now I'm done. Because no, you've created, how are you going to stop, right? So if you upgrade the turbocharger, you need the new brakes, you need stiffer suspension, you need tighter steering. So all these pieces contribute to the greater health overall. And like you said, talking about things being sustainable, if I just strap a supercharger on my car, but I don't change my ability to steer better, be stiffer around turning or stop, well, I've created a problem that eventually under a time of stress is going to rear its head.
And you know what? Here you're at least trying to make things better. Like, you know, I have a Toyota, maybe I'll stick a Tesla engine in there. Good luck to me, right? But sometimes you can make little changes and they can have a huge impact. For instance, we have two sedans. In one of them, you can raise and lower the seats, and in the other, you can't. It's just they're older. But we like them enough, so we're keeping them. But it works out this way that I should really be driving the one and my wife should be driving the other because she's a few inches shorter than me. And you've already confined the system a certain way. If now we went and changed the seat in like one of the cars, we've already changed the dynamic. We've changed the safety profile of the car because maybe now the person can't sit close enough, far enough, high enough, the mirrors, something about them and whatever. And that's just the seat. I'm not talking about engine or brakes or suspension or anything of that nature, right? So even little things can have a huge impact, not where you expect them.
Yeah. So that kind of leads into something, Jay, you were pointing out about the loops and change, the virtuous and vicious loops. If we maybe talked about that a little bit.
Okay, so in a system, some things lead to others. There's like a cause and effect relationship, and then those other things can lead to other ones, and some of them create loops, right? So A affects B, affects C, and maybe that affects A. Some of those loops reinforce change, and some of them work against change. So everybody knows the concept of virtuous cycle and vicious. Well, people know vicious cycle, I suppose, more than they know virtuous cycle, right? But the idea is that those are reinforcing loops, right? If it's vicious, then it reinforces a bad change or in a bad direction. And if it's virtuous, then it's in a good direction. So for instance, a virtuous loop in software development, any product development for that matter, is if I start developing this habit of explaining my decisions and articulating my assumptions. Okay, so when I'm talking to you about, I don't know, this feature or this process or this promise to a client or whatnot, I explain my thinking, I explain my assumptions. It's a habit I'm taking on. I'm going to say that quickly, if other people also pick up on that habit, that's going to be a virtuous loop, right? Because we will make fewer bum decisions because we were assuming what the other person meant, okay? Vicious, an example of a vicious cycle, right, is anything you could classify under Project Lies. Right? We all know Project Lies. Like, I'm 95% done, but I got nothing to show you. The status is green, right? The date is good, or any padded estimate. Okay, those tend to be project lies, right? When they are project, when they are project lies, what happens as a result? Other people learn not to trust you. And so then all sorts of process mechanisms creep up to protect ourselves from each other. Like, you say you're 95% done, but I don't trust you. So I'm going to nag you daily. I'm going to call this holding you accountable, but it's really nagging. And I'm going to look into everything you do, and I'm going to reinforce code reviews and blah, blah, blah. And before you know it, we have included a lot more process overhead because we don't actually trust each other. And we're going to continue not to trust each other because the mechanisms indicate that we don't trust each other. So we're not going to change that.
That ties to, again, Johanna had a quote in one of the interviews we had with her, where she said, you know, we hire adults, we should treat them like adults. And she's not wrong. I mean, you had a line in here, Gil, which I highlighted. Managers, leaders, watch the work, not the workers. And I think that is a almost pithy statement that everybody loses. Like, watch the work, the delivery of value to our customer. Don't watch, you know, what is Mike doing for 8 hours a day? I mean, is that really a good use of your time? Well, some would argue yes, and those are some of the painful people. But yeah, watch the work itself and the system of work, not the workers.
Yes, I wish I knew who said it first. I couldn't find that, right? And the other thing I want to say about that one is, in all the conversations I've had with people who read the book, this is the one statement that they pointed out as in, like, wow, this got me. Seriously, this is like probably like if the book, if we looked at like Kindle highlights or things like that, that one would probably be the most highlighted.
Well, Mike, we passed the test. We're obviously not turnips. We passed the test.
Yeah. Gillis, you were talking about the project lies and how that destroys the trust. It mm-hmm. reminded me of something. I was a couple years ago teaching a class of a framework, and the content was very tightly controlled. Mm-hmm. And me being me, I ad-libbed on top of the tightly controlled content. And half the class was applauding, the other half wanted to throw me out of the room when I told them that Agile doesn't work without trust. And you could take that even further and say, mm-hmm. Working together as people doesn't mm-hmm. work without trust. So I think you're onto the point of it can feel a bit like a, you know, woo-woo thing, like, you know, I don't need to trust you, I just need to be able to rely on you. Well, actually, that is kind of trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if I don't trust you, what do I do? What do I do? Yeah. Whether as a coping mechanism, or maybe I'm taking responsibility because I legit don't trust you, and for good reason, and so I need to act accordingly. That costs us, right? So mm-hmm. the term I use is, you know, it places a tax
yeah.
on our work. That's not my term. It's from Stephen Covey's son. But then that's exactly what happens. So when we do have trust, and the walls can come down, we can do a lot of magic together, right? And everybody knows this, not woo-woo, you know this from friends, right? Mm-hmm. And family members, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple.
Yeah. And it's trust it becomes a very personal thing, which makes some people uncomfortable, I think. But at the end of the day, it's necessary. And
it's necessary to be successful, right? Like
it's necessary to have interactions that don't suck.
Right, yeah.
Right. I think it's because we use the term with wider meaning than we need it to be at work. Mm. So I'm not going to trust you with my kids' life. Okay? Okay? But I am going to trust you as a teammate to do what you think is right and to act in, you know, the shared interest of the company and the team and whatnot. Okay? But I don't need to trust you with my kids' life.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Anybody who wants to dig deeper on trust, Paul Zak, wrote the book The Moral Molecule, which is all about trust and the virtuous cycle and the Holmes cycle, and we did a whole dive on that. Really fascinating. And when you trust other people, it actually comes back to you truly tenfold as far as brain chemistry is concerned. So I think you're right, Mike, and I think Gil pointed out the differences. When people hear that word, they automatically think, oh, well, I trust Mike as my cloud engineer. That doesn't mean I'm leaving my kid. It's your point. I'm not leaving my dogs with him for a weekend if I kind of barely know. I trust him with my cloud engineering. I don't necessarily trust him to take after nine ginormous shepherds. I don't think that's a wise choice.
Now, there is also what happens at the extremes, right? So maybe you trust Mike with 99% of the work, but there is 1% where you need to have multiple eyes on the job, or you do, or you trust and verify, or you need some process in place because the risks are too high. And even though Mike is trustworthy, he might make mistakes. Okay. And that's legit. And it's okay. It's totally okay to build elements into our way of working to protect against mistakes that we call this code review, for instance, right? And there are other mechanisms that we do because we assume that working with humans until AI takes over is kind of error prone. Not that
That
AI
goes
would be
back to the
perfect,
larger
yes.
system. If you've set up a system where it's okay to have imperfections become visible, that it's seen as a good thing,
Yes.
then you get better outcome. Look at Toyota and the way they build
Right,
cars.
right, right. So in the book, I talk about both trust and safety because there are different things. One is interpersonal and one is more of a system matter. But I also mentioned that, you know, when it comes to making the environment more safe, you have to do this across the system and not just in small pockets. So maybe you work in a team where your engineering manager or product manager has created a wonderful environment. And you feel safe with them. But then you look at some of the other teams, and that's not the situation there. And even though you love your leader, you might think, well, they might have to capitulate to some sort of pressure, or they might be, you know, all sorts of things might happen that might compromise this, you know, trust and safety I have with them. So you have to do this across the system.
There was a term that you used in the book, Gil. It's the first time I think I'd seen it put just this way. You talk about doing difficult work. I'm curious if you could tell the audience a bit about that.
Yes. So that one I picked from a marketing book by Seth Godin, where he talks about difficult work and hard work. And then I manipulated things a little bit. The idea is this, that hard work, I mean, all the work we do is either hard or difficult, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be paid as much. So hard work is like when you manage your backlog or you implement something or you deploy your product. But difficult work is where you need to make impactful decisions without a script. And we have lots of those. Anything that is innovative, anytime you need to revise a strategy or a roadmap, anytime you ask for feedback and it comes back and it's not what you wanted, like I mentioned before with my process of writing the book. Or if you need to say no to someone or not yet, right? Especially like stakeholders. This whole idea of, you know, fail fast and learn fast, there's no script for that. It's a principle, it's a good idea, but there's no script for that. And so I pointed this out in the book because your system needs to be able to deal with this type of work.
Love it.
And when we just simplify our process, sorry, when we simplify our process, we may inadvertently only deal with the hard work. Like, here's how you manage a backlog. Here's how you assign tasks. Here's how you do your code reviews. But some aspects of that work is difficult and you need to be ready for it. So in my previous books, I talked about, you know, mindset and really being explicit and intentional about the choices you make there. So for instance, if a code review is, I don't know, it turns out to be horrible, how do you act? What do you do?
Right.
Right? But it's not just the mindset. Again, it's also the sensitivity to the effects in the system.
I love that comparison of difficult versus hard work, right? Like I'm carrying that one forward because it's a good way to think about things. It's a great way to think about things.
No, I just wanted to say, somebody asked me, is this the difference between, you know, complex and non-complex? And it's not. It's not the difference between predictable and unpredictable. It's just, how am I equipped to handle what just happened?
So, Jay, you know, one of your criteria for a book is that if it gives you other books to go and read, at the back, there's an appendix with further reading, and you know, some of it was like real familiar stuff, but yeah, I got a few things out of there like, okay, yeah, that book would be worth
yeah,
to. So it kind of it clears that barrier.
Yep. Yeah, it did for me too. That's honestly, Gil, and for anybody who's listening, watching, that's honestly my cheat. The first thing I do is I go into the back and I look at what is everybody calling out as, you know, for further reading or references or whatever. And when I see a bunch of stuff that I don't recognize or I know is quality, I'm like, okay, now I got to really dig in. This book was definitely up there. Joshua's last book was up there, where I came away with 9 other things I've got to read, which is kind of, that's one of my to read piles. So it's not doing me any favors. But yeah, so listen, we could easily go another hour.
But there is something I want to give our listeners, watchers, that should help them along, even if they decide not to buy the book, and that is chapter one. So both of you have read it. It is not an introduction, right? This is like the summary of the book and the foundation for everything else, and that fitness assessment. So this way people can have, you know, a kind of a written record of the conversation, but then they can also use it with their colleagues to kind of build a shared mental model. So there's a page on my website where people can download that, and we'll put the link in the show notes, right?
Perfect, perfect. And Gil, if people want to find you, they actually have a specific question, comments for you, your website, again, I'll put it in the show notes. Is that the best way to find you?
That and LinkedIn, of course.
Okay, perfect. Well, Gil, I want to thank you for passing along copies of the book. I want to thank you once again for coming on. I love these emails where, hey, I got a new book. I want to come back on. Here's a copy. When can we set this up? I love those. Makes my life so much easier, so much easier. So on behalf of Mike and myself, I want to thank you for coming on. On behalf of Gil, Mike, and myself, I want to thank everybody for tuning in, listening, and watching once again. Please hop on our Discord server. We have a very, very vibrant conversation going on all sorts of topics. This episode will be one of them. So find us there. We do have a Patreon if you want to help offset production costs. We don't ask for much, but if you want to chip in a few bucks, we're always appreciative. And we want to thank Krebs from Machine Man Records, who provided our outro music royalty-free. So once again, we want to thank everyone for tuning in, watching, listening. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.